Today is Wednesday, September 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. World leaders addressed the United Nations General Assembly today.
75 years after the end of World War II and the founding of the United Nations, we are once again engaged in a great global struggle.
We'll have a rundown of the major addresses and what's next as the UN celebrates 75 years, and a look at the flu and COVID-19 so-called twindemic as North America enters autumn. We'll have these stories and more next. World leaders began taking part in the 75th annual UN General Assembly high-level debates Tuesday. Heads of state from around the globe sent in videos instead of physically gathering at the United Nations in New York due to the coronavirus pandemic. U.S. President Donald Trump made the second address and quickly spoke of China and the COVID-19 pandemic.
75 years after the end of World War II and the founding of the United Nations, we are once again engaged in a great global struggle. We have waged a fierce battle against the invisible enemy, the China virus, which has claimed countless lives in 188 countries.
Chinese ambassador to the United Nations, Zhang Jun, heard here through an interpreter, refuted the president's remarks.
We need to increase mutual confidence and trust, but not the spreading of political virus. China resolutely rejects the baseless accusation against China.
Others that sent in their videos that were aired on Tuesday were Chinese President Xi Jinping, Russian President Vladimir Putin, and South Korean President Moon Jae-in. French President Emmanuel Macron, via this interpreter, used part of his time to discuss Iran and North Korea.
It is up to us to fulfill the 2015 agreement, first in time and over time, to make sure that Iran never has access to a nuclear weapon, but also to ensure that we bring a response to Iran's ballistic activities and also to destabilization in the region. Turning to North Korea now, we have supported efforts undertaken by the United States of America to allow commitment and undertaking of negotiations. Even if tangible results have not yet been achieved, the initiative was important. And what we're looking for now is specific gestures of commitment and engagement by North Korea.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani, through an interpreter, took issue with the current state that the 2015 nuclear deal is in.
They accuse us, without any foundation, of trying to build nuclear weapons, and they impose sanctions on others under the pretext of nuclear proliferation. This is why they have the infamy of being the sole user of atomic bombs in the history of humanity, and while the only possessor of nuclear weapons in West Asia is running the non-proliferation theater.
Those are all from the morning session, and additional remarks were given by leaders in the afternoon. Now, for more on the day's activities, I spoke with VOA UN correspondent Margaret Bashir.
So the UN General Assembly annual debate got underway on Tuesday, and we heard from some of the world's major powers. We heard from the United States, from Russia, from China, from France. Four of the five permanent members of the Security Council, all represented by their presidents. This year, the assembly is by video message because of the COVID pandemic, and the pandemic was certainly foremost in those leaders' minds. And we saw a lot of talk about how to contain the virus, but also there was a big focus on the race for the vaccine. And President Trump said he feels there's a vaccine coming very soon in the United States. President Xi Jinping of China said that they have several COVID-19 vaccines in active phase 3 clinical trials in their country. And President Putin touted the fact that Russia was the first country to register a vaccine against COVID in August. And he said that he would like to offer it to the United Nations so they could vaccinate their staff who are out in the field helping people. But I think it's important to note that international medical experts have been a bit skeptical about the Russian vaccine because it was approved when it hadn't even started these advanced phase three trials yet. So there's some question as to whether it's effective or safe. But this was very much on the top of the agenda of the major powers today at the UN.
Speaking of COVID-19, President Trump really has laid out his case that China is responsible for the worldwide pandemic. And you know, we have heard some of the response from the UN ambassador from China saying that they reject that assertion. But since this is the General Assembly and everyone is sharing their thoughts, where does the world fall on that spectrum?
Well, I think the United States is certainly more vocal in pointing the finger at China, but we have heard it from some European leaders, but the rest of the world is a little more quiet about it. They don't, you know, some countries, some poorer developing countries can't afford to aggravate either the United States or China because, you know, they have dependent relationships with these two powers. So, but there was definitely, it was interesting because the messages were pre-taped. You know, when you have a live debate, a leader could hear the speech of his rival, perhaps, and tweak his own speech before he comes out to respond to what he said. So in this instance, it was video messages, and each ambassador of each respective country introduces his president or prime minister's speech. So President Trump had spoken second this morning, and then the Chinese president spoke fourth, and his ambassador took it upon himself to dismiss President Trump's attack on Beijing. He didn't like it, and he said so. And he did bring it up in his own speech, his recorded speech, and he denounced efforts to politicize or stigmatize the virus.
You know, one question I do have for you is, you know, the United Nations General Assembly is an opportunity for all these world leaders to meet and do some diplomacy in the hallway, so to speak, of the UN building there. This is a virtual assembly, as you've said, and they aren't able to do that. Are they making any kind of allowances to hold private video conferencing to have that kind of similar interactivity that they are missing this year?
No, and unfortunately, that's a really, really important aspect of the UN General Assembly, this idea where you can meet a president or prime minister on the sideline of some other meeting, let's say about COVID, and you speak to each other about some other pressing issue. You know, and for new leaders, you know, newly minted leaders, it's a very big deal to come to your first UN General Assembly because you are introduced onto the international stage and you meet your peers. So that is very much lost this year, and that loss is very much felt. But there's no particular way to really do bilateral sort of calls like that. I mean, if they're going to do them, then they're just going to pick up the phone and call each other. So you can't replace that spontaneity or the opportunity where you're here and there are 193 different leaders you can meet with. And, you know, it's sad. At the UN, we're on 40% of building capacity. So even during GA, the building is very empty, and you don't have that electricity and the people running around and, you know, walking down a corridor. You know, last year I was walking down a corridor and I saw the French president. You know, you don't have that sort of feeling this year. And that's very much what makes the General Assembly special. And I think this year it's going to be very much overlooked.
Margaret Bashir is VOA's United Nations correspondent. As we heard, the global pandemic is at the forefront of the discussions that are taking place at the UN General Assembly. Women in the developing world continue to have an especially difficult time dealing with COVID-19, even though statistically more men than women have died from the disease. This is due to several factors, including their traditional roles, their physical makeup and vulnerabilities in what is still mostly a male-dominated world. And to find out more about women and COVID-19, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Susan Papp, the Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at Women Deliver, an international non-governmental organization that promotes equality and well-being for women and girls. Ms. Papp began by talking about women as the go-to unpaid caregivers during the pandemic.
Unpaid care is the care that a woman does when she's caring for her children at home, when she's cooking, when she's cleaning, when she's collecting water. Globally, before COVID, women are three times more likely to do unpaid care than men. But with COVID, that number has gone up because you have more family members to care for. And those women are needing to be able to care for their out-of-school children, but also trying to hold down a job and be able to financially support their families. You also have more sickness and illness in families. So women are really getting pressed and strained. Women are also in a more fragile position in that many of them are in the informal economy. And so they do not have the social protection systems that afford them the ability to take sick leave, parental leave, family care leave to be able to care for their relatives. So oftentimes there's more economic fragility and vulnerability that women face as a result of COVID.
And women who make up a majority of the healthcare workforce are at a higher risk also for a very surprising and practical reason.
PPE, personal protective equipment, is a huge part of ensuring that health workers are safe. But the suits are designed for men. They're not designed for women. That wouldn't seem to be that much of an issue. But when you think about the fact that many of those health workers may be having their period at any given time during the month, are they going to be able to take off their suits fast enough to be able to take care of their hygiene needs? Or are they foregoing their PPE because they're not sufficiently or adequately designed to them? Or are they having untenable hygiene situations as a result of that? Those are all considerations that female health workers have to contend with that the average person wouldn't think about.
So many female health workers are foregoing the gowns because they're so difficult to get on and off in order to change the sanitary pads.
That's right. If the PPE is not designed for women and it's not useful to women when they're menstruating, they may be less likely to wear it, which does, in fact, put them at higher risk of contracting COVID.
And I understand that the COVID-19 pandemic has catalyzed what some have called a shadow pandemic in the form of gender-based violence.
That's right. We've seen shocking increases in gender-based violence as a result of COVID because you have people who are dealing with economic uncertainty and economic stress and all of the mental health components that go along with that economic stress. And they're also stuck with their families and their partners, oftentimes with their children who are out of school. All of that contributes to a heightened degree of tension in the home. And we're seeing rises of gender-based violence in Kenya and Rwanda, Tanzania, Uganda, and South Africa. The GBV information management system in Mali, for example, showed a 35% increase in gender-based violence from the same month the year before.
And even more disturbing, many women are experiencing gender-based violence at the hands of the police.
Yes. Early on in the crisis, they imposed curfews. But there were reports of women who are coming and going from essential work that they needed to be able to feed their families. And they were getting stopped by the police and reprimanded for being out after curfew. And there were instances of sexual and gender-based violence that the police were perpetrating against these women. The police are the last people who should be perpetrating gender-based violence. It makes it so much more difficult for a woman to have the trust in the system to come forward and to be able to report the violence and for those officials to be held accountable. So it's really alarming, the downstream effects of COVID. The Gates Foundation recently came out with a report that said in 25 weeks, we have lost 25 years of international development progress.
Susan Papp is the Managing Director of Policy and Advocacy at the NGO Women Deliver. She was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The United States on Tuesday recorded its 200,000th coronavirus death, a world-leading figure that health experts say could continue to increase by tens of thousands in the coming months. The growing death toll has far surpassed the earliest estimates of the carnage left by the pandemic, a figure that is nearly double the total U.S. military casualties in wars the U.S. has fought in Korea, Vietnam, the Persian Gulf, Afghanistan, and Iraq since the end of World War II. Across the Atlantic Ocean, Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned Britons they should not expect to return to a normal social or work life for at least 6 months, as he announced new restrictions he hopes will suppress a surge in coronavirus cases. Restrictions announced on Tuesday include having pubs, restaurants, and other venues in Britain close between 10 p.m. and 5 p.m., and people will have to wear face masks in taxis as well as on public transit. The size of weddings is also being cut to 15 people, and the return of spectators in sports stadiums is being put on hold. The prime minister said that if the new curbs did not slow the outbreak, he reserved the right to deploy greater firepower with significantly greater restrictions. Statistics tabulated by Johns Hopkins University has put the global number of COVID-19 cases at just shy of 35 million. Doctors and other public health experts are telling people in the Northern Hemisphere to prepare for the worst in the coming months, when both the coronavirus and the flu virus will be circulating at the same time. It's a 1-2 punch that could cause even more deaths and has the potential to overwhelm the healthcare system. More from VOA's Carol Pearson.
Doctors say it's more important to get a flu shot this year than ever before. The CDC says anyone 6 months or older should get the vaccine. Dr. Susan Rehm specializes in infectious disease at Cleveland Clinic.
We anticipate that there will be some people coming up who have both COVID and influenza at the same time, which would be very devastating, obviously, and increase the risk of death from one or both of them. So anything we can do to prevent influenza and to prevent COVID, of course, we want to do.
Both are respiratory viruses. Both can be lethal. And flu season is practically here. Lavanya Vasudevan is a community and health professor at Duke University.
We are going into this flu season with both hands tied behind our back. And we are also working in a climate where trust in vaccines continues to erode.
The CDC reports a sharp drop in routine childhood immunizations because people are afraid of getting COVID-19. But doctors say there is nothing to fear. Dr. Susan Rehm.
All of the healthcare facilities are taking extra precautions to make the environment safe for people who come in.
Even when there isn't a pandemic, Professor Vasudevan says people justify opting out of getting a flu shot.
The flu vaccine is not always the most effective vaccine, so people use that as an excuse to not get the vaccine.
Professor Thomas Denny heads the Duke Human Vaccine Institute.
In recent years, we've been anywhere from probably a low number of 20% hit, and we've been as high as 60, 65% successes.
Experts say even an imperfect vaccine can reduce the severity of infection.
There are also a number of myths associated with the flu vaccine, like getting the flu vaccine will actually give you the flu, which is not possible because the virus particles in the flu shot are dead, so they cannot multiply and give you infection.
CDC data shows that during past flu seasons, 80% of children who died from influenza were not vaccinated. And research from Duke University shows only a third of American adults got a flu shot in 2018. Young children, pregnant women, older adults, and people with underlying conditions are most at risk for hospitalization or death from a flu infection. African Americans and other minorities have a higher risk as well.
It worries me a lot that communities that are the hardest hit by COVID are also very heavily impacted by flu. And we know that vaccination rates are lower in these communities.
Vasudevan says doctors need to work with community leaders to let people know that the flu vaccine can save lives. She says the vaccines also have to be accessible and free of charge. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
VOA has expanded coverage of the pandemic on our website, and still coming up later in today's program.
And then your resulting wines can taste and smell overly ashy or smoky, and obviously that's not a character most people want in their wine.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
A study published in the European Respiratory Journal provides evidence that suggests teens who go to bed late at night and wake later the next morning are likely to suffer with asthma and allergies. It's been known that there's a connection between the body's internal clock and symptoms of asthma. The researchers studied about 1,713 and 14-year-old adolescents from West Bengal, India. They were asked if they experienced symptoms of asthma, such as wheezing or allergic rhinitis, like sneezing or a runny nose. They were also asked questions about their sleep habits, like when they normally went to bed and awoke the next morning. The researchers say they found teens who slept later had 3 times the chances of having asthma and 2 times the risk of allergic rhinitis than those who slept earlier. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A UN official documenting the human rights situation in Myanmar warns the country's national election on November 8th will neither be free nor fair and will not accurately reflect the will of the people. His presentation of a report at the UN Human Rights Council set off protests from Myanmar and its supporters. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Myanmar would not grant the UN special rapporteur entry into the country. However, he was able to conduct his investigation remotely. Thomas Andrews said testimony from human rights defenders, members of Myanmar's civil society, and graphic material indicate that even before a single vote is cast, the election will not be credible.
The results of an election cannot accurately reflect the will of the people. When the right to vote is denied because of a person's race, ethnicity, or religion. And I have seen no evidence that the government is willing or prepared to facilitate the right to vote for hundreds of thousands of voting age Rohingya located in Rakhine State or in refugee camps in Bangladesh.
Andrew said holding an election during a raging armed conflict while combating the coronavirus was immensely challenging. Besides restrictions on movement imposed by the pandemic, he said the government's shutdown of the internet and social media has made it difficult for citizens to get their messages across.
On the other end of this spectrum is the danger that candidates and political parties will choose to use bigotry and hate speech as political weapons. The people of Myanmar know that this poison not only can impact an election, but can ignite violence. There should be no place in elections for these incendiary messages, be they on campaign posters or in the internet.
The UN investigator showed graphic images of what he called poisonous campaign material. That set off dissenting rumbles from Myanmar, Venezuela, China, Belarus, and Cuba. They argued the visual material was manipulative, had not been approved by the council beforehand, and should not be shown. Council President Elizabeth Tichy Fisselberger said all legal requirements had been met.
We received this visual material 2 or 3 days ago. It was shared with the Bureau, who agreed that it could be shown on the condition that the face of the person we have just seen made irrecognizable, which we did. So the Bureau agreed that this material could be shown.
Australia, Japan, and members of the European Union voiced their support for a motion to allow visual, satellite, and other images to be shown. After a roll call vote in favor of the motion passed, the UN investigator was allowed to proceed with his presentation. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An arms depot exploded in southern Lebanon on Tuesday. And earlier today, I spoke with reporter George Eade via WhatsApp in Beirut to get the details.
Well, a loud explosion rocked a Hezbollah stronghold in southern Lebanon on Tuesday, sending up a billowing cloud of black smoke. There was no immediate word by officials as to the cause of the explosion in the small town of Ain Kana. The Lebanese army then issued a statement confirming that the explosion occurred at 3 p.m. in the area and declared that the investigations are ongoing to determine its causes. The southern village of Ain Kana, where the blast occurred, is about 50 kilometers south of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. Southern Lebanon is well known to be a political stronghold of Hezbollah. Hezbollah, a heavily armed and politically powerful Shia Muslim group, set up a security cordon in the area, preventing local media and journalists to reach the explosion site. A Hezbollah spokesperson said the blast occurred at a center for a demining association linked to the group, where unexploded munitions from an earlier Israeli war were being stored. The spokesperson also blamed the explosion on technical error that denied any casualties. Moreover, we do know, according to security sources, that there were 4 casualties. The explosion happened in a residential area. Hence, the residents panicked and fled the area. Some of them, however, remained and watched.
Going back to what was shared about casualties. Do we know if those are just injuries or if those are fatalities related to the explosion?
As far as Lebanese security sources told VOA, those casualties are injuries, and some of them are in a difficult situation. They're from the residents of the area.
Since Hezbollah does have a lot of political clout, and we're still dealing with the ramifications of the Beirut explosion, who's going to be responsible for the investigation to this latest event?
Well, technically, the Lebanese state should investigate and the Lebanese army. But from previous experiences, it would be safe to say that usually such sort of incidents that occur in Lebanon never lead to a transparent investigation. So at the end of the day, it goes by without any serious declaration that can pinpoint or point out who was responsible and what happened. We saw at least 4 to 5 incidents in the last 7 years of the sort.
That was George Eade reporting from Beirut, Lebanon. The wildfires plaguing the western United States could have a devastating impact on this year's wine harvest. As VOA's David Byrd reports, the California wine industry faces huge losses from smoke damage to grapes.
Fire and wine are not necessarily enemies. Barrels undergo a certain amount of what's known as toasting to produce a good-tasting wine. But this year, with fires ravaging the western United States, too much smoke is getting into the grapes and vineyards along the West Coast. Jim Bernot is the founder of Willamette Valley Vineyards in Oregon. He told the Associated Press this year's smoke coverage is unprecedented.
You know, I've been here growing wine grapes for over 38 years, and I have never experienced or seen anything like this.
When too much smoke is in the air, it gets into the vines, which produce the grapes, which are used to make wine. A chemical called guaiacol leads to what experts call smoke taint and off flavors in wine. Dr. Anita Oberholster is an enologist with the University of California, Davis.
And then your resulting wines can taste and smell overly ashy or smoky, and obviously that's not a character most people want in their wine.
Now some growers face the prospect of ditching their whole crop because they cannot find out quickly enough which grapes have been damaged. Oberholster says this produces a ripple effect in the industry.
If we can predict better, then grape growers know, should I harvest, should I not harvest? Winemakers know, should I buy the fruit, should I not buy the fruit, right? It just would make everything so much easier. And we're trying our best, but it's a very, very complex issue.
Labs can test for smoke damage, but that takes time and is expensive. And the massive fires have led to a backup of requests. John Aguirre is the president of the California Association of Wine Grape Growers.
Bottom line is we know some grapes are smoke damaged. What we don't want is to see good fruit rejected and not processed into wine, but because we lack the tools to understand it, detect it, that's what we're facing, is that we're going to see significant losses because good grapes are rejected.
This cascading damage is not only to the winemakers or sellers, but also to everyone who relies on them: pickers, transportation, bottlers, distributors, retailers, and even exporters. Last year, the California wine industry alone sold nearly $44 billion worth of wine in the United States, according to the website wineinstitute.org. Another $1.36 billion worth was sold overseas, with the EU buying up $427 million worth of wine. This year, the smoke could lead to what John Aguirre called the single worst disaster the wine grape growing community has ever faced. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.